welcome to the AVOD. I'm Count Vargelon.
I'm the Dive Mistress.
And tonight we've got a very special show for you. A show that was supposed to be unbelievably prurient, but got delayed from doing that by hilarious circumstance, and is now actually pretty clean.
Yeah.
Unless the Dive Mistress happens to have some incredibly dirty things to say about All-Star Superman, which she might. You never know.
I'll see what I can do.
Okay. Because that's what people come to the AVOD for. Hardcore filth.
Yes. Of course.
Okay, so before we get started with the main event, do you have any random crap, Dive Mistress?
I do. I finally went to go see Tron Legacy.
It's still in theaters?
Yeah.
You know, it came out before Christmas, right? That's a little weird. Yeah,
I know. Well, I got to see it not in 3D also, which is a bonus.
Yeah, it's always a bonus not have to pay an extra $16 to see a movie.
Well, the thing, we were supposed to go and see The Green Hornet.
Right.
But that was only playing in 3D, and we certainly didn't want to pay the extra dollars for that. So we saw Tron Legacy instead. And I actually really enjoyed it.
Wow, so you're the one.
Yeah, that's me. I did. I don't know why. I know I said a lot of mean and unkind things based solely on the trailers that I watched, but I'm going to take them all back.
Really?
Yeah, I liked this movie.
Oh my god. I now wish I had just recently seen it so I could go into all of the ways in which you're wrong.
No.
But I'm not going to. I understand that that is not why people are here, so I'm not going to do that.
No, it was the hardcore filth, remember?
It is the hardcore filth, which people can't get enough of.
But I just...
I will give you the music, though. The music's fantastic.
Yes, I love the music. I like Daft Punk. I've been a fan for quite some time. And so I was very excited to hear the music.
Right.
And I learned something interesting about the music. Actually, they started writing the score when the film was in pre-production.
Really?
Yeah. And it took them about, I think, 2 years to write the whole thing. The movie was, a good part of the movie was cut to the music.
Yeah, that's not surprising at all, thinking of the music.
Which is part of the reason why the music matches so well. If you're a good composer, the music's always going to kind of match what's going on screen, but in this particular instance, the music and the visuals just they come together so well. That's the reason why, because the movie was largely cut to the music, and I think also because the pieces, to my untrained ear, I am not musical, they're more finished, like each kind of individual piece of music is a lot more finished than, you know, if you're listening to another score like Lord of the Rings, for example. I mean, it's great music.
But you feel like you're only hearing sections of it. It's not a complete piece for everything.
Well, you can't listen to, like, kind of one track at a time. So, yeah, you kind of got to sit there and listen to the whole thing.
Yeah. Whereas this one, you feel like each segment is its own complete song that works on its own.
Yeah, more or less. And I really love that. And this is something that I've been noodling for quite some time, and it's something that I thought I might write about down the road. And it's just sort of, I really enjoy scores that are more like the Tron Legacy score, where it is sort of individual pieces that are composed for different parts of the movie, as opposed to like kind of one large sort of orchestral piece of music, but still isn't like a symphony or anything like that. I much prefer it like this.
Okay. No, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're not going to get into the inept filmmaking right now.
We're never going to get into it because I don't want to discuss Tron Legacy with you.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to give that a wait and see. But
no, I'm telling you right now. It's never going to happen.
All right. Like I said, I still like my chances, but... Again, wait and see. More importantly, though, I also have some random crap that's kind of on the same subject. This week, I've been watching the robot fight on Jeopardy.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
IBM wants to build a robot or just an algorithm that can answer questions naturalistically. So
like
you can...
Blue?
Well, kind of. The idea basically being that you could say, you know, where should I go have dinner? And it would know what that meant. Like, it would be able to parse together enough of those things that it could answer a question.
Like Deep Blue?
Yes. Except one that works, because Deep Blue never did. But, and so this new one, Watson, is what they've built to do that, and they thought, well, the most, it's not the most effective way to do it, but it's the most publicity-generating way to do it, is to program the questions it wants to answer, is to specifically be to teach it to play Jeopardy.
Okay.
Because it has to decipher what questions are. And tonight, it kicked the ass of the two best players in Jeopardy history.
Really?
Yeah, it did exceptionally well. Except, I feel it's cheating. And this is what I wanted your ruling on. I wanted to get
cheating because it's a robot?
Not because it's a robot. I'm fine with it being a robot. I'm fine with its brain essentially being, you know, a copy of the World Book Encyclopedia plus the entire contents of Wikipedia.
Which isn't always correct.
No, which isn't always correct. But, you know, a more fact-checked version of Wikipedia is this thing's brain. And I'm not complaining about that. You know, it's a computer. It's going to have more information. What I'm complaining about is the computer does not have to read or hear the questions.
So how does it answer them?
It has the questions. As Alex Trebek starts reading the question, it has a text file of the question entered into it automatically. Now, the thing is, the computer can know that question instantaneously, whereas all the players have to read it or listen to Alex speak it. And you're not allowed to ring in until Alex is done.
It rings in immediately after he's finished talking?
Every single time it has an idea what the question is. I think it's cheating because I think both Ken and the other guy, whose name I don't know, would be doing much better if they instantaneously knew the question and had that extra 3 seconds of Alex talking to think about what the answer is. And that's my problem with this situation. Every single question, it gets a bonus 3 seconds of computational time over the other two. And I don't think that's fair. I think that it should be sent the, I think it should be sent the text file of the question closer to when he's done talking. I think there should be a delay on that for it to be a fair competition.
Okay. No, I'm going to agree with you on that.
Okay. So I'm not a crazy Luddite for thinking this.
No. Given the fact that you don't have a problem with the computer's AI.
No.
You're not a Luddite.
Okay, good. Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm very excited to see the second game tomorrow night, or I guess tonight, based on when this goes up. And hopefully a human will beat it, but I really doubt that that's going to happen.
Well, if they handicap the machine, then probably, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not going to handicap the machine.
Right.
No, that would be, in the same way that they wouldn't give Kasparov a rematch after he figured out how to beat the machine. They're not gonna handicap this thing. They're just gonna call it a win for robotics over humanity and go home.
And this is how it starts, people.
I know. This is completely how it starts. You know, in 50 years, we're gonna be telling, you know, the slave clones of the future about when we saw computers start to take over by winning Jeopardy.
Yep.
So, yeah. You know, look, at least you'll have a story to tell the slave clones.
Slave clones love to listen to stories, so. Oh,
there's very little else they can do when they're off time. All right.
Clones. Hey, look at
we
that.
We were. I know. That was incredibly convenient. Would you care to synopsize our first movie there, Dive Mistress?
Oh, no, that was my clever segue into you talking about Saw 7.
Oh, God, I forgot about that. Okay, yeah, also, I got the weirdest email. I was approached by the, and I know the dive mistress was as well, but I actually got back to the guy. I was approached by the UK promotions arm of, well, I guess whoever's distributing Saw in the UK. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. You can have a generic interview with Cary Elwes. I'm like, I like the idea of a generic interview where you, like, pretend to ask Cary Elwes a set of preset questions. And then, you know, you just have the answers there, like, you're taking part in this. I think that's kind of funny. But more importantly, the thing that really interested me about this was not the idea of getting a free copy, which I'm always in favor of, but more the fact that I'm a Canadian website, and I got the UK people contacting me, and I don't understand how that happened.
Well, I guess because it really doesn't matter where you are on the internet, where in the world, because anyone, anywhere in the world could be reading you. So you could have UK readers, and I know we have at least one UK viewer.
That's true. But the review copy they would send me would be a Region 2 DVD.
Yeah, but that's not a problem for you either.
No, I do have a PS3, so that's not a problem. But
I don't really know. I don't understand why you have a problem with this.
I just find it strange, and I'm wondering, honestly, it's...
I find it awesome.
Okay, I'm not saying it's not awesome, but it's honestly caused me to question whether Canada has its own PR people or whether the whole Commonwealth is being handled by the UK people.
It's possible that Canada just isn't interested in distributing stuff.
Oh, God.
No, it's probably, I'm sure the North America distribution, which is, of course, based in the U.S., covers Canada.
Not necessarily, because Maple is now its own company with its own distribution outlet, so it does all of its own marketing for its own distribution.
Well, I guess we're bigger in the UK than we are in Canada.
Oh, so sad.
That's okay.
Now we're fine with that. We like the UK. See, we even did it at the same time.
Aww.
And that was pretty sweet. No, but seriously, I find this situation weird. Not necessarily off-putting, but it's just, it makes me sad that, you know, Maple Films might not be doing its own aggressive online marketing campaign for what clearly will be one of the hit DVDs of the season.
Right.
See, now, well, I'm just pretending to market it.
That was good.
Even though I have yet to receive a free copy.
You probably shouldn't draw attention to the fact that you're pretending. People are less likely to contact you in the future.
That's true. But no, I am very excited. It's coming out at the beginning of March. And you know what? I'm looking forward to the DVD because I don't know if I've ever talked about it on the show, but I always enjoy the special features on the Saw DVDs for reasons I will get into at a later date because it would take too long to talk about it right now. And it might sound insulting to people listening it the wrong way. But anyway, I think we're ready to move on from this topic to the things we're actually here to talk about.
Yes. Yes, movie. Our first movie of the evening, selected for our viewing pleasure by Camp Vardulon. This is Time After Time. And on the night H.G. Wells shows his dinner guests his time machine, the police come calling. Jack the Ripper has struck again, and the cops are going door to door. In Wells's house, they find a doctor's bag full of bloodied instruments, and everyone instantly comes to the same horrible conclusion. Their friend, Dr. Stevenson, is Jack the Ripper. Stevenson escapes in the time machine, and Wells follows him to the year 1979, with the aim of bringing him back to the 19th century to be punished for his crime. In 1979, Wells meets and falls in love with Amy Robbins, and she helps him track down Stevenson. That's the movie.
That is the movie.
What's the pause? What are you waiting for?
I thought you were going to put some kind of a capper on it. This is a movie that I really enjoy, and I think we're going to get into why of that in a minute, but it was one that I enjoy enough that I almost considered doing it as a movie I couldn't believe the dive mistress hadn't seen. But I realize it's not really a high-profile enough movie to fit in that feature. Sad.
No, not at all. It would have to be a movie that I've actually heard about.
Yeah, that was my point. So, yeah, I'm not... As much as I love this movie, I acknowledge that it is not one of the most beloved classics of the genre. Although, it is one of the earlier, you know, time-traveling Jack the Ripper movies, which is a popular genre.
There's more than one.
There are so many movies about time-traveling Jack the Rippers. You have no idea. Honestly, half of the movie's solution for why they never caught Jack the Ripper is because he is a time traveler. 50% Prince of England, 50% time traveler. I swear to God.
See, when I was... it's not that I didn't enjoy the movie. I did.
Yeah.
But movie is really feels like more of a drama than anything else.
It is, yeah.
And so I was sort of wondering why you had suggested it for the show, because, yes, granted, it's a time travel movie, but that's sort of lesser importance. Almost. It's kind of like, you know, it's this whole fish out of water story, of course, because H.G. Wells is now in 1979, and he, you know, had all these wonderful, rather naive ideas of what the future was going to be like, and it turns out to be, you know, entirely different from what he thought it was. And he sort of, I mean, there, to the film's credit, there really isn't a whole lot of him bumbling around San Francisco. I probably would have turned it off if that's what was happening. But at the same time, the movie focuses a lot on his relationship with Amy. And not to the point of stalling, but that kind of takes over for a while.
You're absolutely right. The romance between the two characters does become a lot of the movie. And if this film seems familiar to you, which it might have, it's because it was made by it was written and directed by the writer of Star Trek IV, another movie about time travelers going to 20th century San Francisco.
The only thing I remember about Star Trek IV is the whales. We've had this conversation.
I know. I just like to talk about Star Trek IV and its connections to time after time. So now that I've accomplished that, let's get back to the movie. I love David Warner in this movie.
He's good. I also enjoyed seeing Malcolm McDowell in a much more subdued role.
I know. He's not over the top at all in this. And
no, he's actually very good.
And at this point in his career, the only thing you associate, you know, Malcolm McDowell with is massively over-the-top performances.
Yeah, no, but this is very, very understated.
Classy, even.
Yes, yeah, as H.G. Wells. He was very good.
And he's very convincing as H.G. Wells. And one of the things I like most about the movie is when he finally has to reveal to them, to her, that he is time-traveling H.G. Wells, that it's not that hard to prove who he is.
No, I mean, she has a hard time buying it,
he has a working time machine and there's an exhibit full of pictures of him.
Yeah.
So it's really not that hard to prove. And I enjoyed that. They gloss over that part of the plot fairly quickly. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, that's good. Because I don't have a lot of time for bullshit. And the movie didn't waste any time with any bullshit. So...
I also, and this is a weird thing to focus on, but as someone who loved From Hell, and a key moment in From Hell, there's this weird, I don't know if you've ever read the comic book that From Hell is based on.
You know that I have.
Yeah, I guess I really shouldn't have asked. I'll lend you my copy. But anyway, there's this key moment where in some kind of a psychotic haze, Jack the Ripper travels to the future. And this sounds strange, but trust me, it works in the context of the story. Jack the Ripper travels to the future and sees the dead-eyed, artless, you know, drones that humanity has become in the modern day, and pities the bleak, unpleasant future. And I thought that, it was nicely reflected, and it might have been influenced by this movie, because there's a wonderful moment in this movie when Jack the Ripper announces that he does not have to be beholden to the rules of being a gentleman because it's the future and people like Jack the Ripper won history. You know, the future is more suited to serial killers than it is to gentlemen. And I really liked that scene and I liked that idea.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that one.
Yeah. And also I like the fact that Jack the Ripper just slaps him around.
Yeah, that was really actually quite shocking. I wasn't expecting that to happen.
I know, and it's so casual the way he slaps him around.
Yeah.
This whole idea that H.G. Wells has never imagined himself in a physical conflict with anyone.
Right.
So it's a simple matter for Jack the Ripper to take off his glasses and punch him in the stomach. And that's all it takes.
I know, and interestingly, I mean, the film doesn't really comment on this too much, but then Wells hits him back.
Yeah.
And again, it's just something quite sudden, and neither one of them is actually expecting it to happen, so they're both... They're both taken aback.
I know.
And it's a good moment.
And the thing is, it's a movie with a lot of good moments. And that's why I thought it was so important that you watch it. And I think everyone should watch it. I think, I mean, it has a nice tidy wrap-up. All of the time travel stuff. I'm not going to say whether it comes from the theory of you can or can't change the future. I will simply say that all the time travel stuff operates under its own rules and never cheats. So I like any time travel movie that doesn't cheat because there's so damn few of them.
well,
but no,
it's so easy, right, to get stuck in, stuck in a loop.
Oh.
Get caught up in that. And when I was watching the movie, I was curious to see kind of what would happen with the time traveling, if it was going to be really fatalistic and whether or not it would address this issue of, you know, can you change the past or change the future? Because they do at one point travel 3 days into the future and then make this sort of terrible discovery. And it kind of, it almost sort of leaves it up to you, I guess, to decide whether or not you can change time if things are set. It doesn't, yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that I think it does pretty... By comparison, I feel it pretty resoundingly answers that question, but that's something we can't get into without spoilering. So I'm not going
spoilering.
To. Without spoilering the situation. But I've just got to say, I was completely satisfied with the time travel aspect of the story. I think everybody puts in a good performance, but the thing I really wanted to comment on is how different film audiences were in the year 1979 than they are today. Because, okay, now I'm going to say it is fair to say that this film was not, in the year 1979, considered a highbrow art film. It was pretty much a run-of-the-mill thriller that anyone could go to a theater and see.
I don't know if I'd call this a thriller.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it would have been marketed as a thriller. In the same way that the movie Clute is a thriller, this is a thriller. Which is not... Actually, yeah, that was a very obscure reference, and I apologize for referencing.
You're going to have to do better than that.
It's okay. In the same way, 3 Days of the Condor is a thriller. Or, you know, I'm trying to think of another good example. You know,
Do you think you can pick a movie from, like, this century?
Well, no, because they don't make movies like this anymore, and that's the point I'm getting to. But anyway, the point is, it's, if not a thriller, let's just call it a drama. But it's a drama that anyone could go to a theater and see. You know, it was not a highbrow art house picture, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Now, what interests me about the movie is the kind of assumptions it makes of its audience that you can't imagine a movie making today. Like, walking into this movie, the film expects you to know who H.G. Wells is. That he's a famous novelist whose novels included The Time Machine, probably what that time machine looked like, that there was a guy called Jack the Ripper. And there's a little bonus if you know Jack the Ripper and, you know, the minor details of his crime. Like, that's all stuff that you kind of need to know for this movie to work that the movie does not tell you or give you any explanation of. And I thought that was very impressive, because I can't imagine that happening in the modern day. Like, being a movie, just assuming you know who H.G. Wells is.
Well, no, I think that maybe if they were to make a similar movie or a comparable movie today, they wouldn't pick H.G. Wells. They would pick a different historical figure that everybody today knows about, that is still sort of front of mind for people today. It's not that, so I don't think that...
No,
it might be a little unkind to today's audiences. Never mind the fact that, you know, I spend a lot of time in movie theaters and I know what kind of assholes. I don't think it's impossible to do something like that today. It's just nobody's tried.
Well, I don't know, and I think the point I'm trying to make, and, you know, if I'm going too far in insulting America's film audiences of today, by all means tell me. But I can't think of a comparable literary figure that they could make this movie about, you know, today and have people know who he is.
Well, you're also assuming that no one today knows who H.G. Wells is.
That is what I'm assuming that. And I don't think, like, a survey of film-going audiences today, I don't think they would prove me wrong when I assume they don't know who H.G. Wells is. Again, I don't want to sound like too much of a jerk and like I'm insulting these audiences, but if we did that survey, you know, I would not be uncomfortable betting $50 that a minority of people walking out of Transformers 3 know who H.G. Wells is.
Oh, I don't... Transformers 3, really?
Okay, maybe that's a little too low.
I think you're biasing your survey.
Okay. Well, we'll pick a more middle-of-the-road movie then when we get around to doing this survey. But for now, I'm going to recommend that people see this movie. I think it's a good movie. I think it's a nice snapshot of 1979. I think all the performances are wonderful, and I think it's cleverly written. It's slower than we expect a thriller to be today, to slow enough that the dive mistress refuses to call it a thriller. I still think people should see it.
I'm not going to defend my position on this.
You don't have to. No, I'm not insulting your position. Oh, ho, Capricorn 1. There you go. That's another example of a thing that at the time was considered a thriller, but today would just be called a drama.
Right.
Is that another movie you haven't seen?
No, the challenge to you was to find a movie from today.
Oh, no, absolutely.
But a thriller is a drama.
I just thought that that would be... You challenged me with that, but I said it wasn't a fair challenge because they don't make movies like that anymore.
And I'm saying that they might, you just haven't seen them.
Okay.
Or I might also be saying that a lot of movies are mismarketed.
Well, no, that's true. Because, I mean, people build friggin' Donnie Darko as a thriller. And...
Monsters, for instance.
Monsters?
Not a horror movie.
Not even a little.
Or sci-fi, I guess. It's none of those things.
No,
it's a love story.
Yes, a love story about two deeply unappealing people. One more deeply unappealing than the other, so there is some variety. But we're not here to still complain about monsters. We're here to talk about our next movie. Dive Mistress?
All-Star Superman. Which makes me think of a sports team.
What?
But anyway, on to the synopsis.
Please.
When Superman saves a manned shuttle mission to the sun, he gets an overdose of solar radiation. It makes him even more powerful than he already was, but, as a side effect, he's slowly dying. Faced with his own mortality, Superman tells Lois Lane that he's Clark Kent, and then, eventually, that he will soon die. Meanwhile, Lex Luthor is put on trial for crimes against humanity and is sentenced to die in the electric chair, a penalty reinstated just for him. Like Superman, Lex is now also counting down the days until his death, but when they finally throw the switch, he doesn't die, and Superman has to foil Luthor's plan and save the world one last time.
There you go. Excellent work.
Thank you.
Your thoughts on this movie? Because I've read the comic book it's based on, so I have all of my just ridiculously nitpicky nerd stuff to say. I think we should get the thoughts of someone who's, you know, a normal person out of the way first.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll start off with saying that it looks great.
Yeah, it really does.
The animation is fantastic. I quite like the voice acting, if I can comment on something like that. It's got good violence for the most part as well. One guy gets laser beamed right in the face, and there's this energy-sucking monster that's quite disgusting.
Oh, God, yeah.
On the topic of the story, I'd say that it does ramble a bit, and the larger story is punctuated by a number of seemingly pointless episodes, which I think are supposed to reveal to us something about Superman, but they really detract more than they add to the film as a whole. And then, you know, we referenced filth earlier, and now I'm going to make an effort to to be kind of filthy. One of these brief interludes or episodes does have the feel of a trashy romance novel. And it was actually quite entertaining for about 5 minutes.
No, that's a pretty accurate description.
It doesn't It doesn't match Mask of the Phantasm for emotional content, even though this is a story about Superman dying and being faced with his own mortality. The Superman movies and the Superman animated series are always quite different from Batman. They weren't nearly as dark to begin with. They dealt with some of the same issues, but in a very different way. And the movie might be sort of a step towards a, you know, sort of darker, serious content, but doesn't go nearly as far as Batman does. And Superman Doomsday, that dealt with death as well, but this one approaches the subject from a different angle. And I guess is sort of tries to juxtapose Superman's and Luthor's fates. I don't know if it's all that successful in doing so, because both of them are facing death, one from quote-unquote natural causes, and because the other one is going to be put to death. What else can I say about this? Anthony LaPaglia does his very best Liam Neeson impression as Luthor, and Reed from Criminal Minds is Jimmy.
Yeah. Which was, I thought, an odd choice for Jimmy. I mean, I didn't dislike it. I just thought it was weird. Because
what was weirder was that Jimmy was at times a cross-dresser for no reason.
Yeah, that got lost from the comic book. The explanation for his bizarre clothing. There's, in fact, an entire... Jimmy gets an entire issue of the 12-inch issue limited series that is just completely excised from the movie.
Okay.
But they actually made a lot of cuts from the movie. For the movie. For example, Alexis Denisov's character, the world's greatest scientist, is basically like the co-lead of the comic book series.
Okay, because, yeah, he's in it very briefly.
Yeah, he basically is just here in the movie for the beginning and the end, but like 50% of the issues visit his lab on the dark side of the moon, where he's working to create genetic superheroes to take over after Superman disappears.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was a fairly major part of the plot that got excised. And another thing that I thought really hurt the film, and I think it's what cut the emotional content that was in the comic book, was missing out on the penultimate chapter, which is right before Lex's execution. There's a whole issue devoted to Superman wrapping things up, writing his whole last will and testament, closing down the Fortress of Solitude, bringing Kandor to Mars and giving the Kandorians Mars as their planet, not embiggened, just having a bunch of microscopic Kryptonians, letting them have the whole planet Mars, which is just a really nice idea.
Okay, well, he does take them off into space, and, you know, there's a sort of tearful goodbye because he doesn't think he's going to come back.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, that's... It works much better when he's also doing that, and the Kandorians, they fail to save him with their super science, because they're scientists and doctors who can travel within the bloodstream, but even they can't do it. But they do cure, like, much of the children of cancer in many of the children of the world.
Oh, okay, well, that's nice.
And it's all a very sweet, this bittersweet goodbye to Superman, with him desperately trying to do as much good as he can before he dies.
Yeah.
And it's all very well handled. And it was it really disappointed me to see, of all the stuff to cut, that was the thing they cut. And
well, yeah, because early in the film, when there's this, you know, one of these weird interludes with Samson and Atlas, and one of the two... You know, sort of I guess Samson is talking to Superman, and he's like, yeah, well, right before you die, you do all of these really amazing, wonderful things, and you answer this unanswerable question. It's like, oh, okay, that might be interesting to watch. And then, you know, Superman answers the unanswerable question, and that's it. You know, there's no follow-up, there's no payoff for, you know, this big setup.
No, there really isn't. And, I mean, for example, the living son gets no build-up in the movie. He's just kind of there.
He just, you know? Yeah, I mean, he appears at the end of the movie, and then you find out that this, you know, it's this double-cross that's been planned since the very beginning. And it's like, well, why am I just learning about this guy now?
Yeah. Like, no, he... Honestly, I think the biggest problem with this movie is that they tried to just film the comic book, like with almost no adaptation, to turn it into a narrative film.
Okay.
And I think that really,
I guess that would account for the sort of disjointed nature of
exactly, like,
stuff
because
that happened.
Yeah, the comic book was not, you know, it's not one of those comic books that tells, you know, a story in 12 parts. It is 12, except for the last one, which is two-parters, it is 12 discrete adventures of Superman. You know, the last 12 adventures, the last 10 adventures he has, and then, you know, his battle with Luthor.
Right.
Right? So it's all very well structured in the comic book. But in a movie, just showing, you know, 5 disparate adventures, cutting the other 5, and then having the fight with Luthor, it does not make a satisfying story.
No, like, you don't, there's no sort of, you're trying very hard to find a thread and follow it through all of these different adventures, if you want to call them that. I'm going to call them episodes. And there
episode, I think, is more accurate.
Yeah, and it just, there isn't one. There's nothing that links Samson and Atlas to the Kryptonians, to any of this other stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
It's like, why, you know, like, you know.
And I think what kind of...
I'm wasting my time with this stuff.
It really did feel like they were. There were 2 parts, though, and this is what really, I guess, bothered me perhaps most of all, which was there are 2 different parts of the movie where they make Superman look like more of a dick and more incompetent than he is in the comic book, and it kind of bothered me.
How in that?
Well... A, when he in the comic book, when he's blown back from Bizarro World, that's where he goes off into space for a month when the Kryptonians arrive. He's on Bizarro World for a month.
Well, that's not in the movie, so you're going to have to talk
about... No, but he comes back from space. It's the same coming back sequence, is my point.
Okay. So, well, like, you could have just cut out the Bizarro World part because it's meaningless to someone who's only seen the movie.
Fine. When he comes back from generic space, Superman... In the comic book, crashes in a field, and some guys raising a tent see him.
We're not talking about the comic book, we're talking about the movie.
I'm also talking about that exact same scene in the movie. He crashes in a field next to some guys raising a tent. You do remember that happening in the movie? I'm not confusing you?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm just telling you it would be better for you and for everybody else if you would say in the movie instead of in the comic book.
I was actually trying to differentiate between the two scenes, but thanks. He crashes in a field, and then all of the guys see him, and he, you know, goes off to check on Metropolis. In the movie, he crashes on the tent, you know, knocking it over and creating a huge hole that almost kills a bunch of people. And then he leaves without fixing the thing he destroyed.
Yes, I did notice that, and I thought that was kind of a mean thing to do. I'm like, you're Superman, you help him out.
It will take you... It has established that it would take you less than 1 second to help them, so why aren't you? There's that, and the far bigger problem where, in the comic book, when Samson throws the Lizard King into space, in one panel, you see that he damaged a couple of solar panels on the International Space Station, which kind of shows you that Samson is careless with his powers, which is one of the reasons Superman is better. In this movie, Samson, theoretically an incompetent hero, but a hero nonetheless, throws the Lizard Man through the International Space Station, blowing it up and killing all the astronauts inside.
Oh no, I think that was a satellite.
No, it was clearly the International Space Station.
Oh, I thought it was just a satellite. Otherwise, Superman would have been a lot angrier with him.
Yeah, and the thing is, I don't know. In the comic, it's clear that it's the International Space Station. And when in the movie it's drawn, it's clear the International Space Station. But I don't think whoever directed the movie knew that it was the International Space Station. So they're like, oh, well, let's you know, globetrotter it up and have him blow up the satellite. Not realizing what the consequence of that was. So yeah, I just thought that made Superman look either incompetent or like even more of a dick than the little tent episode made him look.
Well, no, my problem with the way Superman dealt with Samson thing was that it's obvious right from the very beginning that Samson is just careless with his powers, or not that he's careless, that he doesn't realize the damage that he's causing.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the same thing as being careless, or doesn't care.
Yeah.
not that he's careless, he just simply doesn't care. And that Superman didn't call him to task on that in the beginning.
Yeah.
That's what bothered me with that whole episode.
Yeah, and the final thing that bothered me before we move on is they've taken, in the comic book, when I read him figuring out the answer to the Sphinx's riddle, mm-hmm. I thought that was actually a very clever answer to the Sphinx's riddle. Like, I hadn't heard it before. I thought it was very clever, and I was very impressed with it. And as you know, he's looking at a newspaper. There's a newspaper from the future in that scene. And the kind of joke in the next scene of the comic book is that when he drops the paper later on, in the middle of the paper was this ad where Superman's brilliant revelation, you know, 6 months in the future, has been reduced to an advertising slogan for a car. You know, like, where people don't even really appreciate what Superman does for them, that they are now just joking about this amazing thing he accomplished. Whereas the way the movie handles it is, Superman does not cleverly figure out the Sphinx's riddle. He reads the answer to the Sphinx's riddle off of a car advertisement. Which I thought was kind of disappointing and makes him look like an idiot.
That right there, that's a perfect example of you making, I think, a bit of an unfair comparison to the comic and the movie. Because okay. As a movie watcher, I don't have that kind of that no, other you, knowledge.
I understand
being,
that completely.
You're being like a meta viewer. Right
I am
now.
Being a meta viewer. You're absolutely right. Yeah. I'm not denying that at all. And as I've said before, nobody reads comic books, so the majority of people who see this movie will not have the experience of the comic book. I don't doubt that at all. I just think Superman, if he actually figures out the riddle of the Sphinx, rather than, you know, having an ad tell him what it is, it makes him look a little smarter. I guess that's the only point I'm trying to make here.
Yeah, but I never really pegged Superman as being one with a lot of brains to begin with, because my big problem with Superman in the TV show is that he always answered every question or solved every problem with his fists first before he tried to use logic and reason.
See, and that's the main difference between, you know, Silver Age Superman and modern Superman, and I guess, and this is more about Silver Age Superman, who was first, you know, a scientist and a smarts character, and second, a guy who crushes things with his hands.
Yeah, because in this movie, and in the Superman series,
he does a lot of punching.
He just does a lot of punching.
I know.
And he does the NN in this episode with the Ultra Sphinx. His first reaction is to just punch the Sphinx. It's like, well, that's obviously not going to work. You can see the fucking energy field around him. Okay? Yeah, you're pissed that he's got Lois Lane, but come on.
No, you're absolutely right. And that ticked me off, too. It really did. And, yeah, and it was one of the few places they did change the comic book, and it's, I guess, to make it more like the cartoon, and it did disappoint me. You know, every time, because then again, you know me, I love Golden Age Superman and I love Silver Age Superman. And the Silver Age Superman was basically a mischievous trickster god who, you know, played tricks on mortals and taught them valuable lessons. He was never once threatened, like his life was never in danger. He just went around teaching criminals valuable lessons or his friends valuable yet cruel lessons.
Wow, what a jerk.
He is. Hence, you know, Superman is a dick webpage. Because he really is. But it's a very entertaining in his dickishness.
Right, okay. Like, on that note, I guess.
We can move right along to our final topic of the evening.
Chain letter.
Oh, chain letter.
Oh my god. Okay, so here we go. Chain letter. Neil is sent an emailed chain letter telling him that if he doesn't pass it on, he'll die. So Neil passes it on. Not everyone he sends it to forwards it, and they're killed. The police investigate the deaths using the killer's unique signature to guide them. He kills with chains. The chains lead the police to a cult of anti-technology types who use advanced communications technology to target their victims. But their investigative skills are no match for the killer's killing skills, and eventually, finally, everyone dies. And that synopsis makes a lot more sense than the actual movie.
It really does.
because Chain Ladder is a mess. It is a complete mess. There's no other way to describe it.
Oh my, no, that's true. There is nothing about this movie that is logical or sensible or nor does it track. There's nothing.
I just, in my, I've reviewed this. It's up on Zombot.
And I really want to encourage everyone to read the Dive Fister's PowerPoint presentation.
PowerPoint presentation on what's wrong with the movie Chain Ladder. And in there I kind of summed it up as if they filmed half a script, but not like the first half or the last half. But if your script was 100 pages long, they filmed 50 random pages.
Well, not 50 random pages. I would say 50% of the scenes at random. Because scenes don't end at weird times. But it's like, literally, we filmed scene 1, 4, 7, 8, 12, 16. Just, they didn't care.
And then, maybe they dropped them down the stairs. And then quickly, you know, put them in a pile and delivered that as the finished product.
I think, you know, the Dive Mistress and I discussed this film quite a bit before this show because it really is a compellingly awful movie. Like,
it's sort of mind-blowing in its ineptitude.
But if there's one thing, one lesson that this film can teach potential screenwriters out there, it's that because your film is screenplay is 90 pages long, that doesn't mean it's finished.
No.
Like, we often say things like, don't start writing your movie without a finished script, because, you know, there are movies where Yeah, exactly. Like, don't go and start rolling cameras without 90 pages is a good rule of thumb, because some people are like, we'll finish it while we're making the movie, and, well, we've all seen those movies. Thanks, Killing. But this movie proves that even if you have a completed script, that doesn't mean you have a finished script. Because there's so much of this movie that just doesn't make sense at all. Like, whole scenes come out of nowhere. Characters' motivations make no sense. It's completely unclear what the villain's plan or motivation was. I think somewhere in your PowerPoint you just say, it literally does not matter what the villain wants.
Well, you're presented with a number of options. It's like you can choose from a list. Would you like set menu A or set menu B this evening? So the movie presents you with a number of different options as to what exactly is going on. Is it an anti-technology cult? Is the movie about privacy in the information age? Is it about the pervasiveness of telecommunications in today's society? I don't know. Neither does the movie. It just suggests that this could be a possibility actually committing.
It's true. It absolutely refuses to commit, and that's what makes it a singularly infuriating film.
I think it was actually written on the fly or went through some kind of weird massive rewrite. It just, because it's so disjointed. Also, I think it has like 15 writers anyway.
Really? So.
But I think its biggest problem is that it actually fails to establish a timeline.
Oh, God. And this is not just because of the terrible, you know, how to ruin your own movie opening.
No, which I would argue doesn't actually ruin the film that much. But that's not really important.
That's not the conversation we're having right now.
No, it's that you actually don't get a sense of how much time is passing between scenes.
Yeah.
Because a character dies, his body's discovered, there's a funeral. And you would imagine some time has to pass.
That's got to be like 5 days.
The body's discovery and the funeral. But the cop, the detective, Keith David, is questioning people at the funeral.
I know.
He's done this already. Now is not the time for this.
I know. Oh my God. Yeah, and honestly, this film is one of those movies where if you ever needed to understand why it's important that slasher films take place over a short period of time, this is like the ideal example of it. Because it asks us to believe that there would be a monstrous serial out ki killer out there who was, attacking a group of targets who were easy to figure out who the next target was going to be, but that those targets would have no protection of any kind or not get out of the city.
Well, even if they did have protection or were able to leave the city, I don't think it would matter because it's established partway through the movie that the killer might, in fact, be a magical being who can control chains at will.
Yeah, there's one murder in the film. Well, there's two murders in the film. One of which poor editing may make it seem like a chain is moving around of its own accord, or maybe a chain is flying. Like that could just be bad editing. But there's another scene in the film where a guy crawls under an engine block that's being held up by ding 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 a chain. And then the chain snaps and it cuts the dude in half. And we are given no reason in the film to believe the killer had anything to do with that death.
Right.
Like, the killer was there way in the background, but we don't see him tampering with the chain. We don't see him causing the chain to break. If, as the dive mistress suggested, the killer has psychic power over chains, then yeah, he remotely made it snap, but nothing about the film ever confirms that. Like when Keith David is walking through a room full of chains, they don't spontaneously start attacking him.
Oh, they really push the chain metaphor in this
Oh
movie.
my God, there's like
But the problem with that is that the movie's not entirely sure which metaphor they're going
like what I
for.
love it, it's like if we have a chain in every scene, then people will really get that this is a movie about chains. And you just want to say, but chains of what?
What kind of chain are we
Like,
talking about?
having imagery is not the same as having a message. You, the filmmaker, has to know what that imagery represents, and they clearly don't. Oh, this movie. Like, it's honestly, weirdly, one of these movies that I want to recommend to people just so they can see how, how. This is how you don't make a movie, because it makes
Yeah.
so little sense.
It's like I mean, I said it already. It was mind blowing, in its awfulness. And it just, like, at the risk of repeating myself, it really is. Like, I can't understand how it could happen. Not that something like this could be written and produced to begin with, because we've seen it happen every week on the show. But that they made this movie, and then, at least like five more people had to sit down and watch it before it got released to the public, or unleashed on the public might be a better
Definitely a better term.
And none of those people seem to have had a problem with what they saw.
And yeah, that does seem impossible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem impossible that someone wouldn't have sat the writer di writers and director down and just said, "What does this mean?" and not let them
Right.
leave the room until they offered an answer.
But maybe the problem is that too many people had their fingers in that pie. Everybody wanted to put their mark on the movie. So you get producers start getting involved in this shit, and it ceases to become like the product of a director filming a script.
Okay, I'm just going to put this out there. People who made the movie Chain Letter, if there is an early draft of this script that made sense, please send it to the AVOD. We will review it and vindicate you.
I really like I can't understand it's even though I have seen awful movies, I really can't understand how something like this could happen. Because here's a great example of, the quality of work we're dealing with. You get your opening kill, okay, and it's awful, whatever. And then the title comes up on the screen, Chain Letter, and your movie begins. And then about 70% of the way through, so you're nearing the end of the film, And I'm gonna totally ruin it for you now. Keith David is captured by the killer. And he's about to be put to death, with chains. And the title flashes up on screen again. I'm like, oh, maybe the movie's over now, because, you know, that happens sometimes. Movie ends, you get the title. Roll credits. No, you got about, 20 more minutes of movie still to go. So it's kind of like we came back from a commercial break. And now the thrilling conclusion to Chain Letter. What the hell?
Yeah, that is a part of the movie that didn't make any sense. It was not the only part of the movie that didn't make any sense. But it was certainly a part of the movie. And I just want to, speaking of things that don't make sense, what was Brad Dourif doing in this movie?
Getting a paycheck.
No, I'm not, okay, I'm not denying the man money. Obviously, I want Brad Dourif to have money. I'm not crazy, but, like, his whole scene in this movie just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think that was sort of one of your possible options.
Yes, for what the movie means.
At one point, it suggested that Brad Dourif might have something to do with his larger plot. But there's no, you don't find out one way or the other. He's just there to hit on a student and to lecture them pointedly on the topic of privacy on the internet.
And to, oh, by the way, to establish that it's very cheap and easy to get a device that can make cell phones not work, which a killer having in a slasher movie situation would be really useful, but then that never comes up.
No.
One of the many, yeah, many things this film brings up, but then doesn't resolve.
I just, yeah, oh god.
Shameless.
The movie flashes back to scenes that we never saw. Keith David flashes back to events that he didn't witness. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it really doesn't.
I mean, it makes sense in the fact that you can follow the story.
What story there is.
What, like, little story there is. It's not incomprehensible.
I would say that this film has less story than most modern slasher films. It certainly doesn't have any characters.
But the way they tell their story doesn't make any sense.
No, that's true. Yeah. Like, the way it's structured is just bizarre and awful. And it doesn't make a lick of sense.
Why choose to film those scenes?
Of all the scenes.
18 instead of 17.
Of all of the scenes you had in your epic screenplay, Chain Letter, you know, why did you pick those 50 random scenes? There had to have been 50 better scenes than those.
Maybe there weren't. Oh, God.
Oh, God. God, what if the other half of the movie that wasn't filmed was even worse?
It just wasn't filmable.
Okay, now we're just being mean to Chain Letter. Although, again, Chain Letter was mean to us by existing. So
fair.
It does deserve a little bit of payback. Although, I gotta say, this film is so captivatingly awful that I was able to get, like, 3 blog posts out of it.
That's true. So I guess there's something to be for horrible movie chains.
Okay. And with that in mind, I think it's time to move on to Narcissism Watch. If you'd like to head on by Vargelon.com, I wrote 3 articles about Chain Letter, all of which can be read. I justify why it's a how to ruin your own movie. I investigate the questionable fake journalism. And then I write a rambling cry for help sort of piece about why I don't understand anything that happens in the movie.
If you'd like to swing by zombots.net, you can read my review of Chain Letter, which I wrote as a PowerPoint presentation. So, slide by slide, we'll take you through a plot synopsis and a criticism and analysis of Chain Letter.
I just wish there was some way you could make, or maybe you can do this and have it downloadable from your website. Like, actually release the PowerPoint presentation so people can open it up in PowerPoint and watch it as a presentation?
I probably could. I'm not the most internet savvy. So at present, the slides are posted as JPEGs.
Okay.
So you can just, you know, you'd have to click on one to bigify them individually. I'm sure I can probably figure out a way to make the actual PowerPoint presentation
download. All right. Well, we're going to wait for that because fingers crossed. I think the kids of America would love to bring that into their classrooms.
All right. For everyone taking film criticism and analysis, freebie.
Freebie. She won't even sue you if you call it your own work.
Oh, I might do that.
Actually, you probably will, come to think of it. I should not have promised that
money.
At all. Okay. All right. So would you like to give us some poll results, Dive Interests?
Yes, poll results. Our poll last week was, what lives in the darkness?
I'm excited to find out.
The answer is more darkness.
Really?
Yes, and there was a three-way tie for runner-up, ghosts, monsters, and the hell dimension.
I am really shocked that more darkness won.
More darkness lives in the darkness. What were you for, the hell dimension?
I was kind of rooting for the hell dimension.
Yeah, most people, I thought that would for sure be the winner, but...
Most people felt there's just more darkness in the darkness.
Just more darkness in the darkness, yeah.
I guess that tells you something about the kind of people who are watching the AVOD.
So be sure to swing by the AVOD's blog at theavod.blogspot.com to vote in our upcoming poll.
Are you going to tell us what that poll is?
No.
Okay. Just wondering. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. I did mean to put her on the spot.
You do it every week.
I do.
You put me on the spot, and it's always the same.
Yeah, it really is. And I would make the argument it has yet to get old.
I don't know. I might go a different way.
Unsurprisingly. Well, okay, until next week, where we're going to be back with a review of three more movies and perhaps a very special guest.
Indeed, yes.
Three very, I'm just going to give the spoiler alert. Movies whose titles we wouldn't be comfortable saying in mixed company. Next week on the AVOD.
Until then,
I'm Count Vargelon.
I'm a dive mistress.
Thanks for watching and have yourselves a great evening.
Good night.